Hello, everyone. I'm Veronica Diaz, Associate Director for the EDUCAUSE Learning Initiative, and you're listening to an ELI podcast on the MOOC. Today, I'm joined by Phil Hill and Michael Feldstein, EdTech consultants and analysts and frequent commentators on the MOOC. Welcome, Michael and Phil. And I will begin with our first question, which is the New York Times reported yesterday, as you probably read, that Coursera has just raised an additional $43 million in venture capital. So what potential do you think investors see in Coursera that would prompt them to make such an investment? And we'll start with Michael.
Well, in some respects, the calculation may be simpler than we imagine. Investors like to see a platform on the internet where user base is growing rapidly. And that's certainly true for Coursera. There is a calculation that at some point the company will figure out how to make money off of all of those eyeballs. Coursera does have a revenue model, and here, again, it may be simpler than we imagine. They are charging for students to get certification for the courses that they take on the platform. And given those numbers that they have in terms of growth of total overall users, they don't have to get a very high percentage of their users to buy that certification in order for them to make significant money.
Phil, did you want to add to that?
I agree with what was said. I would add sort of time is another dimension on this, that I think early on, you know, up through today even, I think that the interest is from investors looks at education as a space that has to have some change, and there's a lot of money flowing through there. So I agree that there's an opportunity here, and they're looking for people that can acquire a lot of customers and are showing consumer interest. It's almost a consumer phenomenon. They don't know exactly where the money will come, but I think that they know it's a general space and a general opportunity that they care about. The one thing I would add is that over time, I think that's changing. And in one respect is over time, and the investment community does have a tendency to follow each other. So I do think that we're also getting into a, hey, I've got to jump on the bandwagon from an investment standpoint. And it is a hot topic. So to be quite honest, I think that's becoming more of an issue as well. It's just investors making sure they're on the bandwagon. The second thing I would add is that I do think that over time, the investors will start requiring or asking for more concrete business models. So I think that over the next 2 years, there will be a lot of interest from the investment community on saying, okay, we've got to move beyond just consumer interest and start identifying the specific opportunities of where money can be made. And the certification, you know, the numbers I've seen from that, I think it might be able to help pay for the company's operations, but that's different than justifying the size of the investment. So I think that it might be a starting place as a revenue model, but clearly the MOOC providers are going to have to go beyond that to justify the size of the investment coming in.
So Coursera and other MOOC provider data is showing that many MOOC participants already have degrees and that MOOCs are having difficulty attracting some of those degree-seeking students. And maybe we can break this information down and understand what it signifies, if anything. In a recent Forbes article, they cite the opinion that students don't go to college to learn. You probably think one of you wrote a blog post on this. But for the college-going experience and for the prestige of the institution, and they hope that that experience in turn will lead to a good job. So this is connected somehow, I think, to the concern that MOOCs are going to replace something. Do you think they will? Do you think they threaten online programs, face-to-face programs? What market, if any, do you see them intruding upon?
Well, one thing I would start out with is I think that the Forbes article, while it was interesting, I think it was oversimplistic in its characterization of colleges, and it sort of focused more on the elite colleges and traditional student aid. So I had some issues with the article and its simplification of the issues. However, I think that the biggest threat that I would see that MOOCs have from a long-term perspective is that it actually challenges a lot of the assumptions of higher ed and a lot of the assumptions that higher ed has had in place to prevent it from examining its own practices, evaluating its own effectiveness, evaluating why does it cost more for an online program than it does for a face-to-face. So the biggest long-term threat I see is that because of the nature of using the internet, the scalability of MOOCs, plus the very hyped up public discussion, it's forcing universities to publicly confront their assumptions that have not had to do in the past.
Yeah, I agree with that completely. There isn't a whole lot of evidence that Coursera and edX style MOOCs are an imminent threat to either face-to-face or online programs. But faced with tuition that's been rising through the roof for a number of years now, I think parents and students are finally looking around saying, well, wait a minute, maybe we don't have to pay that much money. Maybe there is an alternative. And asking the folks at the colleges and universities for a first time to justify the expense. And that will lead to changes. They may not happen next year or the year after next, but there certainly are investigations going on now that will lead to alternatives that are lower cost, but provide some level of confidence to parents and students that they're going to get a quality education that maybe they don't feel about today's MOOCs. And when that happens, there are going to be some difficult challenges for universities.
So the other thing that's kind of implicit in the Forbes article is that, you know, employers don't really value online learning or online educational degrees. Do you think that the growing, kind of the rise of MOOCs and the number of students that are learning through online modes, that that will start to kind of build a tolerance in the market and a better understanding of what to expect from those kinds of students, and also maybe stop using the institution as a proxy for quality? Do you see any of that happening?
And again, I would actually disagree with the premise of the Forbes article. I do think that employers do not reject credentials just because they're from online universities. I do think that they pay attention to who the institution is, so that they do use the institution as a proxy for quality. But that's different than saying, hey, we don't value online at all. If it's an unknown online brand versus a name brand face-to-face, that'll make a difference. But there's a big opportunity as the name brand, more well-known institutions offer their own online options. I do think that's changing and increasing the business desire to accept these as credentials.
Yeah, so what most employers are looking for is a strong, reliable, and above all, quick and easy to read signal that the person that they're looking at is worth considering hiring. And it's been easy, for example, to use, you know, Stanford as a proxy because, number one, one assumes that you get a good education at Stanford. But number two, one assumes you are smart if you got into Stanford in the first place. So I don't think it's an inherent bias against online, as Phil is saying, or any other form. It's just that they need a quick read. Now, there are employers, increasingly in the tech sector, for example, who are placing less and less value on that quick read because they don't feel like it's necessarily telling them what they need to know. And in those cases, particularly with jobs where you want someone to have skills that school isn't necessarily great at teaching, again, IT is a good example. You can have students, undergraduates, come out with an exquisite knowledge of the theory of software engineering, but not have a lot of the practical skills that are necessary to build a product in the real world. And in those cases, employers may be increasingly inclined to look at micro-credentialing. So not just whether you got a degree, but whether you took the course from Coursera or edX or Udacity or wherever it is and got some kind of a badge or certification.
To build on, I think that's a long-term trend. So to go back to your original question, I do think that the threat to institutions holding a monopoly on being the proxy for quality, yes, I do see that going away long-term. It's just going to, in my opinion, take longer than a lot of people, particularly within the badges type of movement, seem to assume. And I would also agree that I think the tech sector and skills-based jobs are the leading front of that. So I see it as a very long-term trend that might have some real impact in the 5 to 10 year period. But I don't see a major movement to remove institutions as the proxy for quality in the short term. It's just starting in certain areas.
So for this last question, I'll ask you to put your visionary glasses on, which I think you all do quite frequently, actually. So everyone's trying to understand the MOOC through the current lens of educational programs and problems and needs. They'll finally solve the access problem, or they'll be able to better prepare entering students. But what applications are there for the MOOC beyond what we've currently seen or have hoped for, do you think?
I'm particularly interested in the kind of work that you see folks like Jim Groom and the DS-106 community doing. That's DS-106 is a project-based MOOC, in essence, and I don't even think they call themselves MOOCs. I think they position themselves in opposition to MOOCs. But essentially, it's an open online course that can get more or less massive. And what I like about the approach is the notion of using a curriculum and projects and some, not necessarily synchronous, but synchronized learning over the course of a syllabus to jumpstart a community of interest or a community of practice. I think, for example, a structure like DS-106 or a project-based MOOC would be a wonderful vehicle for getting a group of faculty across schools or even across states to explore different ways that they can use technology in their own classrooms.
And the one thing I would add to this, and I guess it's a general trend, but I think it's significant and not looked at enough, is I think that MOOCs long-term are going to challenge the whole assumption that one faculty should design one course in all cases, and that's the gold standard of quality for a course. And I think right now MOOCs are somewhat limited in their pedagogy and the way they've been delivered, but that's going to be changing over time. And part of what you're going to see, and Michael recently wrote about this, is you're going to start seeing a lot more of the evidence where team-based design of course material, particularly for lower division courses and in, you know, specific disciplines, will start to become the norm. And so that sort of intrudes or puts them in opposition or in the same market spaces where a lot of the publishers are going. And we've, you know, written about this from a courseware perspective. So just the long-term opportunity to change about what is the core content of a course that will accelerate the move away from just a flat textbook and more into a team-based design of rich multimedia and interactive course content that faculty will build a course around in the future. So I think it's going to change some real assumptions there and advance the industry more into a team-based design assumption in many, if not most, cases.
Well, thanks to you both for joining us today and for all of you listening. Don't forget to check out ELI's 7 Things You Should Know About June issue, which is on the MOOCs. And we'll look forward to joining you at our next ELI podcast.